Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello and welcome to the Theorist-Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and their compositions, hosted by music theorists. My name is Aaron DiZarilla, and I'm a graduate music theory student at Florida State University, and I will be your host for today. The music that you were just listening to is an excerpt from a piece titled Modest Mutilation by the composer Gabe Kokoski, who is the featured guest on this week's episode alongside his music. That leads me to welcome Gabe Kokoski himself to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Aaron.
Of course. It's been quite a while since we've spoken. To everyone, Gabe and I went to the same school for our undergrad, which was University of Florida.
Yep. Go Gators. It's fantastic to see, you know, you going in your own direction and me going in mine. Both at state schools now. Yeah, you're at Florida State and I'm up here at Penn State.
Up in the great white north. I'm sure you miss the humidity.
No, not at all. Not one bit. The snow makes me very happy.
Okay. So Gabe, go ahead and tell the audience about yourself, your background, personally, professionally, academically, whatever you choose.
Yeah. So, I mean, my name's Gabriel Jakuski. I use he, him pronouns. I'm currently doing my master's of composition up here at Penn State University, working very closely with Dr. Baljinder Sekhon. And yeah, I mean, I did my, like Aaron had mentioned, I did my undergrad in composition and theory, a dual degree at the University of Florida, which was great, you know, happy to be moving on, you know, next chapter of the life and whatnot. But I've always been pretty active musically. From a young age, I started playing violin through the Suzuki method for about 8 years. Then I picked up trumpet in middle school, high school. And then, you know, I got to college and I was like, I want to keep going with this. I felt in a sense that I had to do something music related. And then I didn't want to just, I kind of wanted to prove to myself that I could like do something else. So I was going to go performance, and then I got into theory, and then I was like, oh, I really like writing music. So now I'm writing music, and that's what I love doing. So here we are.
Yes, here we are indeed. And you mentioned it at the very beginning there, and I wanted to ask you, you're the first person that I've had on here, one of, I hope, more in the future, that is something of a music theorist yourself, not just a composer, as you said, a dual degree. And I remember in the fall of our senior year, sitting through a music theory presentation that you gave on a paper that you were doing in our informant analysis. So can you, we're going to talk more about the fields themselves later on, but can you speak to more on a personal level, or even in your career so far, what it's like having a foot on both sides of the fence in a way?
Yeah, I remember that day so well. I was so very nervous. I've never taught a class, and now I'm, you know, teaching, which is fantastic. But I was doing a presentation on, what was it?
It was something with prepared piano.
Yes, it was. Well, it was a player piano.
Player piano.
Kanlan Nankero's Piano Study Number 7. And I remember, because this was Forman Analysis 1, I believe, or was
yes,
it 2?
Okay, it was one.
So it was dealing a lot with, you know, sonata form, rondo, all that. And so I was like, okay, this piece is in a sonata form, but instead of being divided by key areas and by this tonal structure that, you know, we normally base form off of, it was divided by rhythmic canons, which is something that Kanlan Nankero really liked doing. So I was like, why not present this? And I remember all of the looks of bewilderment when I played the, you know, the music and had everybody try to follow the score, because it was really fast. And I had only like 30 minutes to try to cover the whole thing. Little bit off a bit more than I could chew for that one. But as far as, you know, when I first started picking up composition, I was very much, you know, into theory first. And then I was like, let me, you know, try writing some music, took some of the required like composition skills courses for the major, for the theory major, and then that just kind of sparked my love for the whole discipline. I used to think, oh, being a better theorist makes you a better composer, being a better composer makes you a better theorist, and vice versa, but I've kind of graduated to a different mindset of nothing really exists in that clear of a binary. Where it's like, oh, are you a theorist or are you a composer? Everybody's kind of a little bit of both. I'm under a great belief that everybody should write music and can write music. You know, and anybody that practices music should include writing music into that. And, you know, we can talk later about the discipline and how it's taught itself. But yeah, I kind of... The further that I got with music theory, the more abstract my own thoughts on the discipline became. And in a roundabout way, the music that I write now is not as theoretically intense as the music that I would analyze, because that's not the aesthetics that I'm, you know, concerned about. And that's kind of like, the aesthetics are the law. It's like, a Debussy quote that says, pleasure is the law, when he was, you know, using all these planing dominant chords and, you know, being called impressionistic when he hated that label. I just took a French music course. I'm like, you know, this is right off the top of the noggin for me. But my music is very aesthetically driven. And I see it more so as, you know, theory is a set of tools that I'll be able to, you know, whatever I want to say, theory is not going to necessarily help me form what I want to say. It'll just give me a vessel to do it. It'll give me a medium to do it.
In reference to the first half of what you said with that class that you taught, I think our professor, Dr. Pellegrin, could have prepped us a little bit better in that at the time, yes, we were talking about sonata form, but it was the Rhenish Symphony. It wasn't, it was certainly not an abstract sonata form. And I think back to that presentation, and now I'm in a graduate music theory program at a pretty high up university, and that's right up there with the sort of presentations I see on a weekly basis. But at that point in undergrad, it was like, oh my gosh, what is happening? It was fantastic though. You talked a bit about your compositional aesthetics and compositional style a bit. Can you speak to what that is? If you were to describe broadly or abstractly, if someone came up to you and said, what does your music sound like? Whether that's a style or a composer, however you choose to describe it.
I mean, since I'm pretty early in my compositional career, and you know, I think one of the hardest things when people are just first starting out is really creating a voice and like some level of consistency. But I find the more that I write, the more, you know, consistently it sounds like, oh yeah, Gabe wrote that piece, you know, and you could kind of like pick it out. But I've bounced around from a few different aesthetic camps, and right now I'm really, really hooked on hyperpop. I love hyperpop so much. I love how tongue-in-cheek it is. I love how self-aware the genre is. I love how queer the genre is. And it's just this amalgamation of being a homunculus grown out of the digital age. Like I love it so much, and I like the level of overt self-awareness that I try to apply it to some of my music. You know, I'm still trying to find more sophisticated ways to do that, but I think this division of music being either highbrow or lowbrow, not only does that have like very racist connotations with eugenics, but also it has this connotation that like mu music can be qualified, you know, in a spectrum of good and bad. When I think it's more of a question of whether, you know, a composer's idea was successful or unsuccessful, how they, you know, wanted it to be conveyed. And so with that, you know, some of the, I look at some of the things that are typically seen as this not as advanced, not as complicated, like a four chord melody or a really catchy tune, or you know, a simple chord progression, catchy melody, you know, annoying sounds, repetition. That's a huge one too, just like blatant repetition, which kind of, you know, ties into some of my minimalist inspirations of, you know, really driving something home. But I also, you know, I'm composing through the lens of somebody with ADHD, appealing to, you know, an ADHD focus of, oh, if I'm listening to a Mahler number 5 and you know, I'm trying to draw a line and follow a small unfolding idea for the whole symphony, that's going to lose my interest. You know, that might lose my interest, and I want to stay interested. I want my music to get stuck in my head.
I totally support, and I'm so happy you said that because I feel exactly the same way. And it's like the music that I feel weird saying this, but I guess the music I specialize in analyzing, or at least do the most often, is pop music. And I say that with a big capital P. I just did my a final presentation on like the compositional history of Rick Astley.
That's great. That has taken the bit to the nth degree, you
Yes,
know?
yes, it is. So I can I really appreciate that. That's not to say anything less of Mahler's music, but I also
For sure.
understand that train of, I know you're not saying that either. I understand that train of thought greatly.
Right. And I think it's, you know, I actually am just finishing up a seminar on Mahler, which is really funny. You know, yeah, I'm just, you know, scraping exactly what I remember from my two semesters here so far. And you know, one of the things that I've talked about, I even in one of the semester the seminars that I audited at UF with Dr. Dahlman on music and audience, right? Like analyzing the audience. The audience has really like changed from the time that Mahler was writing music and Strauss around that time, you know, to today, where we see it a lot with music critics. Like music critics now are just trying to get space, like real estate on a column. So they'll say heinous things or attention-grabbing things and whatnot. But back in Mahler's time, you know, music critics would get the score in advance and analyze it. You know, that everybody was a theorist that would engage with classical music because that was like the popular thing to do. It would be, you know, like today going to Forever 21 and buying a Childish Gambino vinyl, you know, and reading all the liner notes. And you know, studying that before listening to it, and you know, that's seen as kind of like indie today or whatnot, or cool, or falls under an aesthetic. But there's definitely just a different profile of how people listen today. And music historically is, you know, one of the slowest changing art forms. If we look at visual arts, you know, it's worlds ahead. We look at, you know, if you look at like the music curriculum that we're being taught in our institutions, respectively. today and from 50 years ago. Like, if you take the syllabus of what it takes to get a master's in theory from 50 years ago to today, it's probably going to be like identical.
It really is.
You
It
know?
really is.
It's going to be like post like 20th century theory and then like everything before that, and that's the two, like it's a binary, it's easier to do it, you know?
Let me tell you the four classes I took last semester, and three of them were required. It was Intro to Schenkerian Analysis, Music Theory Pedagogy, Posttonal Analysis, and Counterpoint.
Yeah, I mean, and that's that would have been the same thing, you know, back
Yeah,
then, like.
it's not to say that those aren't valuable subjects. They were great classes, and they're still important to learn in their own right. But it's just, like you're pointing out, it's a funny parallel of immovability.
Yeah, it's this idea of what, like, and it's just kind of perpetrated by our field in general about, you know, the past being the good old days. Oh, we have the geniuses and we have the masters and the masterworks, you know, that we keep performing as if earlier was a better time than now. And that, I feel like that sentiment just perforates every aspect of institutional music from where we are, and reacting to that is a big part of, you know, my compositional process of trying to think, you know, about all of that, you know, and or and at the same time, like thinking about, I had a really good conversation with one of my professors, one of the musicology professors here, Chuck Humans, and we were talking about how sometimes it can feel really insignificant putting all this effort in, you know, to write a major work or to publish a book or, you know, do all of this research when like there's an active genocide happening on the other side of the world, you know? And like, how do you grapple with trying to make a difference and like make your surroundings a better place when there's like the nth magnitude of other things going on, which is a very like Malarian way to look at things, kind of poetic in a sense, considering I just spent so long with this guy's music, of, you know, this kind of fear of mortality or like, you know, what's it all worth anyways, kind of vibe. So not to get depressing on the situation, but these are things that I think about when I write my music, and ultimately I kind of come back to the idea of building the world you want to live in and trying to affect a community around you and making it, you know, trying to make the world a little bit of a better place for what you can experience in the current moment.
This is a beautiful conversation, and I almost hate to move on from this area of
It's okay.
topic, but we will return to it. But of course, we need to be, or I'd like to spotlight your piece that we're going to be talking
Oh,
about
yeah,
today.
that little old thing.
Yeah, that little thing. And so I actually I think in a way this is a good segue because you're speaking about how you conceptualize music, the story within it, and the purpose behind it. And so the piece that we're going to be looking at today, the one that you sent me and the one that the listeners will be hearing as well, is Modest Mutilation. Now, Gabe, explain yourself with that title. I say that a little accusatorily. I had a strange reaction to that first one, and it obviously, as most things do, it made much more sense with the program notes. But can you speak to the audience? But what that title is, the message of the piece, or what you were thinking about with it.
You know, I like titles. I keep a running list of like, oh, that'd be a badass title, you know, or like, oh, I
Oh,
really like that, you know.
such a composer.
Yeah, it's okay. Sue me, you know, guilty as charged. But specifically with this piece, I knew how I was gonna write it. You know, I knew that for a really long time, tracing back to, you know, when I first started composition, which wasn't too long ago, I was really drawn to Philip Glass, particularly, you know, Einstein on the Beach and Ne5 from Einstein on the Beach. You know, it, like we could even put a segment in here of clips from almost every single one of my pieces that derives from that. The first sound installation I ever, you know, did was called Measuring the Ocean with a Teaspoon. And that comes from the monologue that the narrator is saying in Ne5 when he's talking about the story of love and how, you know, the guy can't explain how much he loves the girl, so he says, measure the waters of the ocean with a teaspoon, you know, number the grains of sand on the beach, Count the stars in the night sky, you know, it's impossible tasks. So I knew that this piece influenced me a lot. Nephi influenced me a ton, and I was kind of getting sick of it, you know. I love the piece so much. I could turn around and just, you know, go play it because, I mean, minimalism. You only got to know like 30 seconds of music and then just rep it, you know. Okay, I mean, we'll talk about performing minimalistic music because that's a whole other ride, you know. But yeah, so I knew that this influenced me a lot, and I kind of wanted to do a farewell to it. I wanted to, you know, write a piece that was as blatantly influenced by Nephi as possible and, you know, make it my own and send it off and be like, I'm done here, you know, moving on to the next inspiration.
You know, that there's kind of a sadness in that almost. It's like, it's not to like infantile all of it, but it feels like the end of Toy Story 3, like saying goodbye to like a whole mode of life, you know?
It definitely does. And I you know, I felt prepared to do that. A lot of the music that I write, you know, I like to write about the human condition a lot. And, you know, specifically being in a digital age and, you know, not just like the 2000s version of that where it's like, oh, the internet, it's so fast, you know, but just what that actually means and how that's affected, you know, everybody. So I try to take individual moments that I feel and try to make them larger. I know there are a lot of composers, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I need a disclaimer, like straight up, you know, that write music based on their own experiences, like exclusively. And that's completely fine. But I like to abstract those in a sense of like, you know, if I'm feeling this, then maybe somebody else has felt something like this too, or could get something out of it. So in that sense, you know, I wanted this, the title, Modest Mutilation, is referring to the more that you hold on to something that you love, like the tighter that you hold it, the less like itself it's going to become. So in the sense of me holding this piece really close to me, you know, it got distorted into something that it's not. But if you hold like a loved one, if you're really overprotective of like a loved one, say like a child or whatnot, that child's not going to be like that child anymore after a while. They're going to be a reflection of you. You're going to mutilate them even though you have, you know, this positive intention of protection and of shielding. And I think it's poetic in a way of like letting art exist in isolation sometimes, or letting it have, you know, a timeline of its own and not messing with it.
Oh my gosh, this is making me feel kind of sad.
I'm sorry.
No. Just to say sad is kind of simplistic. I think, although at first I thought the title was a little absurdist, which I guess in some ways it is a little bit, but
for sure.
But especially after reading the program notes, and I'm sure the people listening will be able to feel this after hearing the piece some and hearing your rationalization just there about it, it really does make you just zoom out a little bit about thinking about what you're holding on to, what you should be and should not. Is it really what it was, and so on? So I like what you're saying about how, you know, I'm personally one that prefers to engage with music that has an explicit meaning or message or story or so on. Doesn't need to be. Music for music's sake is always fun. But I like, even if it doesn't have an explicit compositional meaning, I like to attach things to it. But I really appreciate your abstraction of experience in that you can mold, within limitations, mold the meaning of your piece to adapt to whatever the listener, the analyst, or whoever's experiencing the music can adapt that experience to their own in different changes and ways. So I think that is a very thoughtful way to interpret musical meaning.
That's, I'm happy to hear you say that, because I've been called out for that being BS sometimes, you know, of like, oh, it's so vague that you can say it means whatever you want it to. But I try to be so intentional with that. I really do. And I appreciate, you know, you recognizing that, because I do a very similar thing. If I'm listening to a piece of, let's say, absolute music, music for music's sake, I'm going to try to attach a meaning to it, something that, you know, will allow me to relate to it. So as a composer, I want to make a space for somebody else to do that, you know, for somebody else to interact with this piece and be like, oh yeah, that's what I felt, you know, or to just zone out and be like, that was cool. Oh, that was a beat drop. That sounds great. You know, like four on the floor right there. That's groovy, you know, for them to encourage a reaction instead of just a complete zone out is you know, to reduce my goals into just like one statement. That's what it is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on the comment of if you make it so abstract or so loose that it can really mean anything, that criticism gets thrown at so many different kinds of art and art analysis that in some ways it's true, but I feel like that criticism is used without moderation, if you know what I mean.
For sure, yeah, it's kind of reckless and overstated in a sense. And, you know, similarly to how I was describing music reviewers earlier, sometimes people just want a reaction. They just want real estate. They want a column, you know, they want to call art BS, or they want to look at a very simplistic piece of art. Or let's say like people rag on minimalist art a lot. So if a columnist will write a review about a piece of minimalist art and either tear it to shreds or absolutely adore it, it's going to generate a reaction, which I think it's almost poetic in a way, because I see the purpose of a lot of art is to, you know, get a reaction, you know, inspire some sort of thought. What that thought is can be like handicapped, and, you know, it can also be super free, which is kind of what we're talking about here. But then when somebody reacts to it and wants their reaction to get a reaction, I like that is a level of, you know, that is, it's abstracted, because then itself, like the column of, you know, then you're creating a canon around this initial piece of artwork where there's now a reaction to the artwork and there's a reaction to a reaction. And even the artwork could have been inspired by something else. So I'm really drawn to that ecosystem and that like lineage of like, oh, I wrote this piece, Modest Mutilation, and it's based off of a Philip Glass piece. And where did that come from? Oh, it's Einstein on the beach. So something about Einstein, you know, some people might love or hate this piece and then they'll go write about it and, you know, X, Y, Z. It's a funny world we live in, you know.
It certainly is a funny world that we live in, yes. And I appreciate your takes on that. I think that's very insightful to an artist's intention and grappling with the reaction to such intentions. Now, so to speak about Modest Mutilation on more of a technical level, you detail this in the program notes, you use a particular method of analysis or data collection, granular synthesis, to help construct the piece. Can you explain as generally as possible to the listeners what granular synthesis is, what it entails, how you applied it, and how you decided on that as something to use for this piece?
Yeah, so I mean, just to talk about granular synthesis, we got to talk about what a grain is really fast. And I think the term was popularized. If somebody cites me on this, please do. in Micro Sounds by Curtis Rhodes, I think maybe it had been like thrown around or used or published before then, but that's where I know it from. And essentially, like, you know, a grain of sound is the smallest perceptible unit of a sound. So it could just be like a little blip. But if it's audible, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can hear the content of it, but it comes from a, you know, a greater thing. And so, you know, grains have been used in a lot of electroacoustic compositions, you know, on the electronic side, to create a different way of listening, of taking these and either screwing with your perception of time, of where is that coming from, or creating sound masses. So grain clouds are like a you know, a huge thing. And that's just when there's a bunch of little, you know, tiny sounds happening that may have come from the same source, may not have, but they're these small imperceptible sounds that together create a mass. And that mass is like a different way of engaging with music, apart from melody, harmony, rhythm, where it's just this blob, you know, per se, of something that you can feel, like a block, whatever, and that you can perceive as a mass. So with that, right, now that we know what a grain is, I got the idea from my colleague Brendan Sweeney, currently dissertating at University of Florida.
Shout out, Brendan. Is he almost done? as well?
I believe so. I believe he's almost done. He's living in DC right now, but is completely ABD. So yeah, all his coursework's done. He's just dissertating.
Oh,
dissertating
good
on dissertating. Yeah. So I got the idea from him. He wrote a piece for the Jack Quartet, and he took one of Beethoven's string quartets and threw it through this sample granulator. And he, you know, aesthetically, he wanted to create a new type of variation technique, where if we think about, you know, a theme and variations, theme is laid out, and then you just kind of add more ornamentation as time goes, gets more virtuosic, more whatever. But he wanted to put that through a granulator and break it up and then completely rearrange like this piece from an original thing. So I was like, I really like that idea too. I would love to see that patch. So he sent me that Max patch. I messed around with it, edited it, you know, on my own, and essentially took sections of knee five, put them into the granulator, which this granulator, it would go from either really small grains to large. So when we're talking about length of grains or, you know, size of grains, it's just how much you can hear in that, you know. I think it would go from like a fraction of a millisecond, which you can still hear. It might sound just like static or like, you know, an audio artifact, up to like a second. And so I could like reverse which way they would go, whether it would, you know, get really go from really small to really large, or vice versa. And I could also change the envelope of what each grain was. So the attack, right? The attack, decay, sustain, release. I could change that. And most of them, I just kind of made like triangles of, you know, it's either going to start really quiet and get really loud over the course of it, or vice versa, or it's going to sound like super staticky because I just drew scribbles in the envelope box. You know, I just played around with it. I took this, made a mock-up in Logic, and then I transcribed it. So I transcribed that this piece that is now like completely granulated, you know, all over the place, and is also for violin, narrator, choir, and synth. And I was like, I'm going to take this and I'm going to make it for a sax quartet. So there was this level of abstraction of like, how am I going to do that? Which I guess kind of goes into, you know, the process, a bit more, but I essentially sat at a piano and I learned the whole thing. And so I'd say like 95% of the material in the piece are direct sonorities from my granulated mock-up. So throughout the piece, you know, I was saying I could take the granulator and make it go from big grains to small ones. That happens quite a few times. And it gives this like speeding up effect because the grains are getting smaller and smaller. Or, you know, I think, yeah, that's the only way that I really go, is like small to large. And then I think I did small to large and then like flipped it. So there's some like reversal in there. And then I was posed with this, you know, since I learned it all on piano, I could tell just by listening to like a single grain, if I just looped it, I could tell what part from the bass line of the song that it was at, you know, what part of knee five was it on? So if it was an A, then I knew it had to be this set of other pitches that were happening, or so on and so forth, right? Then I got to the problem of speaking. I didn't want my performers to speak verbatim. I wanted to abstract it just a little bit. So I came up with this idea of using voiceless articulations, which it's an imperfect system. I worked with a linguist, and I then found out after working with a linguist that like actual linguistic IPA and musical IPA aren't approached in the same way.
To interject, what does IPA stand for?
The International Phonetic Alphabet. So if you think, you know, back to the Phoenicians trying to trade all throughout the Mediterranean Sea, creating the first alphabet, they are just like the basic units of sound internationally that like the mouth can produce, and different symbols will mean a different type of sound that you can produce. So if you can read IPA, you could read any language, essentially. Not necessarily like the meaning, it's just talking about the phonetics or the, you know, what it orally sounds like. But yeah, so I decided, you know, I don't want them to speak. And the speech is also, I mean, part of that was the speech was getting so messed up that I didn't want them necessarily saying gibberish, but I still wanted it to kind of sound like gibberish and fit the vibe. So I went with these voiceless articulations that ended up coming out kind of like air sounds. Mm-hmm. I liked it. It was good. It kind of, you know, I wanted it to be like you are articulating, you know, on your instrument, but in these different, I tried to really go for voiceless plosives. So things that don't require like vocal cord activations and are really just done with like the lips and the tongue and, you know, hitting the teeth. And it kind of worked. It kind of didn't. It was an imperfect system, but I really liked the end result. That Project Fusion, which was the quartet that I wrote this for. Definitely check them out. I'll send you links to, so you can put it in the description.
Yes, of course. And so to surmise a couple of things, not to summarize, because thank you for the description of granular synthesis and what a grain is. And if any of it was lost on people, that's okay, because it is a very difficult subject to grasp upon. but I think you did a fantastic job of describing it. So you essentially use that method to compile different modes of data to then use those as tools to construct the piece, to taking portions of it on a fundamental level and plugging it in or adapting it. Is that about right?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it was, think of it almost like a filter, you know, like if you're going to put reverb on something, you know, I just kind of did that. But I was selective with what parts and how I was doing it, but I put it into the patch and then it came out the patch into a new piece.
Yeah. And what I did, my method for these interviews and analysis is to always listen to the piece. Of course, I read the title because I see the audio file, but I listen to the piece first as if I was an audience member and try to guess what's happening. And I could tell just without any context, I wouldn't go as far to call it Modest Mutilation a minimalist piece. But as you've very well described, and as anyone could probably guess by now, the aesthetic is there. And we've talked about aesthetics previously. And if you listen to Knee 5 and Modest Mutilation back to back, it's a tricky thing to say because there's obviously inspiration. Mm-hmm. But you didn't it's interesting because the granular synthesis accomplished taking direct inspiration but transforming it into abstract inspiration without it. It is a very interesting technique of adapting without directly adapting. I don't know how to quite describe it. And so, you know, as you know, as a maybe former minimalist composer, if you want to say that, or formerly minimalist inspired composer, when you choose the pitch material, it is of course any composition, it's essential, but most especially a minimalist, because you're dealing with an economy of means. You're only using so much or you miss the point of minimalist. So when you're choosing what to take from the granular synthesis and the analysis from that, how did you balance between keeping the aesthetics, but also keeping the aesthetic intact? Because you really could have gone crazy with it and taken all the grains you wanted and manipulated them as much as possible. So how did you keep yourself in check to keep the aesthetic while also going further? Because it clearly does.
I really appreciate this question. I'm so thankful not only to be here, but that you listened to my piece more than once, believe it or not. That's fantastic. I love it. So I mean, part of it was I wrote this for Project Fusion, which you should definitely check them out. They're super cool, super cool people. Love them all. And they were coming doing a residency at Penn State. They were, you know, working with the sax, you know, studio and whatnot, but they also, we got them to do some reading sessions for us, for the composition studio. So the three current composition graduate students, we all wrote a sax quartet for them, and it was a reading session. So part of what kept me in check was knowing that this had to be feasible in about an hour of, you know, sight reading in a controlled environment.
That is a very responsible reason and answer.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was definitely part of it. But I also, I realized, you know, I've talked about my, you know, aesthetics previous, you know, on this episode about my influences of hyperpop and, you know, attention grabbing and whatnot. But I'm realizing that, like, you know, I really realized with this piece that I can sit just a little bit longer on some of my ideas. Like, I can let them germinate for a second, not to like a Malarian, Wagnerian like length of 6 hours, you know, hate Wagner, whatever. But, you know, I can allow them a little bit more time to breathe and give it almost like respecting what I just wrote, you know, like respecting this idea and respecting the space and respecting the aesthetics of minimalism, because I was trying to operate, you know, reacting to that canon, where it's almost pseudo minimalist, you know, it's got, direct inspiration from this minimalist piece and moving forward from there. But I appreciate the question about the pitch material. I kind of, you know, just took it all from the grains, like what I could figure out. But through analyzing, you know, Nephi myself and using inspiration, I'm really drawn to, you know, the fact Glass does it a lot of kind of abandoning the tonic dominant pole that we think of a lot of, like tonic being home and dominant being this pool that will take you back home, you know, or just sitting in those two realms. Because like I had mentioned, I see so few things now as binaries. And that even applies to theory, where I, you know, that's like one way to do it. But with minimalism, it's almost, you know, creating other benchmarks of, in Ne 5, it's just, you know, like a four chord cycle that keeps going. It almost reminds me of like a hexatonic cycle, like in Neo-Riemannian theory, of going major to minor, then moving a third away, major to minor, you know, like it creates almost you start at any point in it and you can stay within the cycle. And that's something I really like about Glass's music. And I particularly like about Ne 5 is it's so simple and you could listen to it for hours. And then it's, you know, it grows just a little bit, changes to something else. And the work was kind of done for me, you know, using this much inspiration from the piece. Yeah, I've also interacted a lot with like analyses of Philip Glass's music, and there's a lot that, you know, people can get into the weeds of, when I really think it comes from like having a head for that aesthetic and being like, this is the world I'm living in and I'm going to replicate this, you know. Some people can really get in the weeds of like, this note comes back 60 measures later, you know, and this specific tessitura, you know, is important because XYZ.
I know that you're not in school. I know you're not in grad school for music theory, but don't call us out that hard.
Okay. All right. Listen, I love all the music theorists. That's why I'm here. Yeah. This is my community service to the theorists. I'm kidding.
you say that a lot of your work was done for you, but I think, you know, the practice of purposeful compositional restraint is a practice in developing your musical maturity, because that can be difficult. You know, you probably remember earlier comp lessons. I had to have comp lessons in undergrad too. You write like a theme every two measures or something like that. Of course, this is not that extreme. But yes, I think that modest mutilation is definitely a great practice in how to adapt a style and inspiration and be in this almost uncanny valley of new and old, which it goes into the theme of the piece itself, which is what makes it really cool. To go back to the IPA notation and the incorporation of mouth sounds and such, let's say we're doing a narrative reading of the piece. I know that it accomplished a timbral goal that you had to create variation and whispery sounds and so on. But what in the story, the idea of the piece, the narrative, why were the IPA notations, where did you decide to place those within the piece? What is it saying, the intensity or lack of intensity of those elements?
So they correspond to the grains where people are speaking. So the whole piece is it starts with the synth going like A G C, not like that's exactly what it is. And then it has the chorus coming in saying 1 2 3 4, 1 2 3 4 5 6, 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8, and then it has two speakers saying, would it get, or the sailboat, and all these little blips of things, and then it launches into a triple meter section of a narrator describing something else. So when I took these grains, the synth sounds, or the sung sounds, I corresponded to actual pitches so that I could get those sonorities, still preserved in my in Modest Mutilation. But when it came to speaking, that's when I decided to use the IPA. I was like, okay, so this part of speech, maybe it's the middle of her saying, the, so it comes out as like, or sailboat, or things like that. It's chopped up, not necessarily perfectly or right on the beat. And so instead of using actual words to approximate that in a I that would be a bit more of a literal approach if I just used the exact same words and had them speak them, but chopped up how the grains chopped them up. I kind of wanted to smooth out the edges, and that's where the IPA came in, of it abstracted it in a way that rounded it out and didn't make it feel as jerky as the premise of the piece is. The premise is very much section, 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 grain, 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 grain. One does not have to relate to the other. It could be choppy if I wanted it to, but that was kind of the experiment that I did with this, of I purposely didn't put in a lot of indications that I wanted it to sound artificial and choppy, so that the musicians, when they read it, that they would smooth it out on their own, and it would breathe the new life of like organic mass into it. Which I really appreciated, how Project Fusion approached that, and they did a fantastic job. I'm so indebted to them. Yeah, shout out Project Fusion if you ever listen
Oh,
to this.
I hope they will. I'll be finding their social media accounts to
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'll send it to
correspond.
them. Absolutely.
Yes. And so about the mouth sounds, this really wasn't with IPA, but one of the, I'm not going to say confusing because it wasn't disruptive, but one of the most unsettling parts of the piece, something that maybe purposely was meant to not sit completely peacefully within the listener, is at the very end of the piece, you finish your texture, your melody, what you're doing, and you have a fermata over a measure of rests, so an indefinite pause of rests or somewhat indefinite, and then a return of clicking keys that comes up in volume and then slowly fades away. When I say it's confusing, I don't mean that it doesn't fit. It fits just well with the aesthetic. But what are you saying when you have that? What are you doing?
Yeah. So, going back to the how I organized the piece through the sample granulator, I either had small to large or large to small grains. Each chunk that I took had a progression of large to small for the most part. It had a progression. And my challenge then, was to create a system or multiple systems of representing this density, these grain clouds, that, you know, end up at the end? And how do I represent that? How do I represent this very electronic thing? So through it, you know, the very beginning, you know, very long grains, and it goes, you know, to smaller till it gets to that 30-second note flurry of just a massive sound. And then I was like, okay, massive sound, great. Let's try metering it next time. So I have all those like metric modulations towards the end of the second section. And then with this final section, with the key clicks, I was like, what if we just abstract, you know, like pull out all of the harmonic language, and we just leave the essence, like the vibe of what I was trying to do, which was, in this case, it was take the small grains and make them big. So it started with a grain cloud with a flurry of clicks, and then it got longer. The grains got longer at the end. So it was kind of like large to small, small to large. Flip them up on the third time.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I suppose I was thinking of more of it in a personal experience, almost spirituality way of, oh, what is this meaning to me? Which I guess in a way is, you know, your intentions of abstracting the purpose of the piece to be adaptable to the audience was successful in that light, because you got me thinking immediately without even having context what was happening. So one last thing about Modest Mutilation that I want to talk about is something unique so far with people that I've interviewed is, instead of sending just an audio file, you sent a specific link to your YouTube page where it was accompanied, the recording of the piece was accompanied by an animation. One that I'm going to have this of course going to be included in all of the social links to your information, but I'm going to have a specific link to this animation with the piece, and I encourage everyone to watch it with nice headphones. It's a very neat experience. And I wanted to ask, how did that collaboration with the animator come around? What was that like?
Yeah, so, you know, it initially started of, I wrote this piece, I got it recorded, you know, I worked with Project Fusion, it was great. One of the things in the curriculum for our composition master's program here is we'll have these career building things. And one of them was like, oh, make a piece and attach a video to it. And I was like, okay, I mean, like, yes, I can do that. I could just record, you know, people playing a piece. But I've always wanted to work with an animator. And so I was really set on that. I was like, I'm going to find an animator who's going to animate this piece. The problem is I am a master's student and I'm broke. And animators are really expensive, and rightfully so, because it takes so much work to do a little bit, like a lengthwise of animation. So I approached some people, cold called them, you know, and I ended up finding through a friend of a friend, Dernis Markov. And I will also give you the link to his socials. Fantastic animator. He's the one that animated the accompanying video for Modest Mutilation. And he would, you know, he didn't do it for an exorbitant amount of money. We cut a deal and decided to start working together. And he was really drawn to my music from what he said. He really liked it. And he was like, this will be great. I have some ideas. And I specifically didn't give him any creative direction. I was like, going back to abstracting the meaning, I wanted him to listen to it and be like, take whatever meaning you feel and then do that. So that's what he did. And he hand drew all of the panels of this animation, which was insane. And I worked together with Project Fusion to fund it so that he could be properly commissioned for this project. And when he finished, it was great. I premiered the video. It's great having the video now, because I can just, it can be its own fixed media piece of, it's taking that recording and the video, but also I have capability to make the video accompanying, so people could play with like a movie score live if they if that's something they're interested in. Yeah, so it was just a really, you know, all around a fantastic experience. And if I ever work with an animator again, it will probably be Dernis, because he was really good, really, really fantastic.
Yes, there's a whole area of both composition and theory, as you well know, that is completely dedicated to the relation of the visual arts and audio, and music specifically. So much analysis with it, and I feel like there's a lot of meat on the bones when it comes to even your piece with that animation. It was so artful and impactful. I can imagine it in a dark room on a projector alone in an art museum as an installation with that video and surround sound It's just absolutely surreal to watch and listen. And of course, I'll make sure that the artist, the animator, what's his name again?
Dernis Markov.
Yes, we will make sure that it gets plenty of attention and notoriety for the beautiful work that he did. And I thought that was a great addition to your piece. Part of the podcast. Now we already kind of discussed a whole bunch of it at the beginning, which was really fun and natural. But let's talk about the fields abstractly. What does composition mean to you? What does music mean to you?
You really,
Really light
this is,
questions. Really
yeah,
light.
I was about to say, this is, I could throw around the, it's too vague BS that we were talking about earlier, and I'll subtweet you about this, actually.
I'm giving you the keys to the car. You can drive wherever you want.
Well, so composition as a discipline or theory or,
No, just to you, the art of music and what you do every day and what you're going to school for and hoping. But, again, very light question with that. But what does it all mean to you?
I mean, it to me, like, it's a creative escape. There's like there's no doubt about that. That's kind of a given. I know very few people that like survive in any form of music without loving it. It's a, like, and sure, people will fluctuate, I'll fluctuate of like, oh, am I really doing the right thing for me? Is this, should I just go pursue something else? Especially when I'm broke, I'm like, it would be really nice to do anything else right now. Go to trade school, drop out, a little bit of, I was talking to somebody, one of the professors who will go unnamed, and he was like, yeah, I actually really like it when people drop out of music school because it shows a level of self-preservation and like self-care that the
What kind
rest of us
of, I guess you get an A for honesty, but what kind of comment is that?
No, it was definitely like, tongue in cheek kind of thing of like, no professor's like, oh, I hope you drop out, but it's kind of like a silver lining, But yeah, I mean, music to me, like I was talking about, is really, building the world that you want to live in. And I really like all the people that I've met, for the most part, like in the contemporary music field, performers, composers. And it's a world that I really want to be a part of, and I want to contribute to, and I want to give back to this ecosystem and participate, and be around these creatives. And because it's a very fulfilling thing for me to be able to talk about music and to, like talk to you on this podcast. This is fantastic. This is the most fulfilling to me, is being able to like talk with other creatives about music. Music is like, I mean, I don't think it's universal language. I think it's more than words. It's very transcendental in that way, and it's very broad, and it's very it and it needs a lot of change too, And so I feel like the more people that are in music, the more variety of approaches that we can find. And so I kind of feel like, I'm doing a small part of that, of just adding variety. Notice there's no qualification to that of like good variety, bad variety, because I don't think that really exists. Just having more people expressing themselves in a vulnerable public way, I think is healthy and, and empowering to other creatives.
Yeah, I understand that perspective. It's a very all-encompassing one as well. And so maybe more specific to, you've already somewhat answered this. If you want to expand on it more, or you can just repeat yourself, it's really up to you. Composition as an entity and music theory as an entity. I find it interesting that you said, that in of itself, and even the dynamic of this podcast is somewhat of a binary. You have the whole intention is to have one theorist and one composer, or at least one person who mostly identifies as a composer, one who mostly identifies as a theorist. And I mean, even at Florida State, I don't know what it is at Penn State, but it is a binary within our department. We're one department, but there is the composition side, there is the theory side. And you talked about earlier about the conjoining, or at least not necessarily the conjoining, but the spectrum between the two different areas and the usefulness, the utility, or the importance, so on and so forth. What are your thoughts on the field of music theory and composition? The intersection of such, the efforts to combine them or even separate them.
Yeah, I mean, great question. Again, you came with the heavy hitters. What I really mean by like I don't really I try not to see things in binaries as is. I think there's a lot of beauty in nuance. There's a lot of beauty in the specifics and whatnot. If we overgeneralize everything, then you miss out on a lot of great things with everything. Like if you said every tree is just a tree, then you wouldn't get to, notice the difference between a maple or an oak or a yew, So with theory and composition, I feel more so strongly about that, about them existing on a spectrum, of not like, oh, it's theory or it's composition or somewhere in between. But when you think about like the field of musicology and theory and composition, they all existed as one at one point before breaking off and being specialized, right? And because you couldn't essentially like do history without knowing a level of theory or composition, because with theory comes like a knowledge of like how to write things. The difference I mainly see when we get into like the disciplines of theory and composition is they both might have the same tool sets, but they're applying them in different ways. Which again, I like the beauty of nuance. I'm glad, these fields are separated and whatnot, but I think people's identities as a theorist or a composer or a musicologist or a musician are multifaceted. And to say that you're one more than another, I think is just kind of what you spend most of your time on. I currently, I you know, I'm wrapping up because as it comes to the end of the semester, a techniques of composition course here at Penn State, where I'm teaching non-majors. Non-composition majors, how to compose in like a one semester crash course. And I always tell my students, they're just as much of composers as I am. The only reason I have the title is because that's what I spend all day, every day doing. That's what I want to identify as, and like a group of people that I feel comfortable putting that identity on myself. And sure, like I have a composition degree, but I don't think that's as much of a qualifier, other than just kind of a proof that I took a set of institutionalized classes, which I think there's I like that there's nuance and there's people doing nuanced things, I really appreciate that because it's you can really get into the weeds of what maybe somebody else doesn't care about, and you can spend a lot of time having a lot of fun with that, at the end of the day, we're all just trying to, be happy, and be happy with what we're doing. And so, who am I to say that should like go away? The problems that I do see, going forward and what have already reared their ugly head, especially in composition, there's a lot of predators, in composition. There are quite a lot. I know this kind of like a curveball. I was talking about like the academic side of things,
That
but
was about, I did not expect that to come out of your
right.
mouth. Well,
I mean, it's just, it's clear as day. And it's perforated, all musical institutions. Just recently, with the New York Philharmonic, and prior to that, like numerous ones that don't get public coverage, because it's, yeah. I mean, there was a really good, I'm forgetting her name right now, but it's, she had equated or discussed the issues with how the New York Philharmonic had handled the situation with, the two assailants and the predators that they invited back to the orchestra. As like when these kind of things happen, everybody knows that they're already going on, right? It's just whether or not the story is going to break, whether or not a journalist is going to fight hard enough to get that story to break. So it's it's kind of this good old boys like cover up of, oh, that shit's happening, but we're gonna stay quiet about it because I want to keep my job. I want to, I want this person to keep my job. Oh, they're my friend. There's not a moral accountability in, I mean, a lot of the arts, not music exclusive. There's a lot of like of morality that has been lost and that needs to be accounted for. Needs to really come back. And I think, the institution itself, especially when we think about our theoretical approach, being very Shankarian based, I mean, you can kind of draw a lineage of like
Oh.
how that influences, our way of thinking about music and,
Oh. Oh, Gabe, yes you can.
yeah.
Yes you
Yeah.
can. You know
So
it.
it's yeah, and I know that's like that's a lot, and I'm definitely I don't feel qualified or comfortable to, talk in depth about necessarily these subjects, but I think it's an important thing that, it has to be at the forefront of everybody's mind for things to change. And it sucks that that's the way that it has to be, but that's how it has to be.
Yes, and although that was certainly a curveball, in a way, though, philosophically, it's very interesting to hear your thoughts and to hear any guest thoughts. But, theory, just like theory to composition, there's also reality. And that is, you were just naming a very deep and dark reality of parts of the field of music, composition, theory, too, all sorts. So that's still important to highlight, as you said. So, on that note,
That was a really good connection you drew. I do appreciate that. Spoken like a true theorist, which
spoken like a.
that is not a derogatory remark.
I'll take it. I'll take it in stride. I'll take it good. So, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I really have loved having you on. And how can listeners? I'm going to be listing the different things that you sent me, but how can the listeners best contact you for any questions or inquiries or comments?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow my Instagram at Gabe.Jacuski, which I mean, that'll be in the description. You can also check out my website at Gabriel Jacuski. That's how I, sign all of my compositions, but you can just call me Gabe. You could DM me, you could, go to the contact form on my website or contact Aaron and he'll set you up directly. That's fine.
Yes, I certainly will. That's part of the point of all this. Yes. But as Gabe said, all of these things will be in the description of wherever you're listening to this. Gabe, thank you very much for coming on to the Theorist Composer Collaboration. This has been a fantastic conversation, and thank you for sharing your piece, Modest Mutilation.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Aaron again, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. Another big thank you to Gabe Jakowski for joining the program alongside his composition, Modest Mutilation. In the description of this episode, regardless of the platform you are on, there will be links to Gabe's website, email, and social media, and I would appreciate it if you could show him some support. His information will also be readily compiled on the corresponding contributor page on our host website as well. Modest Mutilation was performed by the ensemble Project Fusion, as Gabe mentioned in the episode, and a link to their website will also be in the episode description. Additionally, there will also be a link directly to the YouTube video containing the animation that Gabe mentioned, created by Dernis Markov. I would encourage you to go and show support to Gabe, Project Fusion, and Dernis altogether. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to subscribe to our email listing on the homepage of our host website and follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. Relevant links are in the description. You can also listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and YouTube, so make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. Again, all relevant links are in the description. TCC episodes are posted weekly on Mondays, and don't miss our weekly blog posts, which go live a few days after a new episode is added. I'm also very excited to promote that our next featured composer is Dr. Nico Gutierrez, with his masterful orchestral composition, Teogonia, featured as well. You won't want to miss it, but until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.